Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
We live in a world defined by economic numbers, yet few of us know where they come from or what they really mean. Zachary Carabel, author of the weekly Edgy Optimist column for Reuters and a regular commentator on CNBC, MSNBC, and CNN, tells how the famous leading indicators that we place such faith in came to be, why they are in many cases actually misleading or just plain wrong, and how he came to create his own indicators to guide our most important business and personal economic decisions. He does so in the new book, The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World. Zachary Carabel, welcome to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you.
What brought you to look at these numbers, these indicators?
Well, I mean, having spent years both as an investor and then writing about these numbers, and also having been trained as an historian, it began to be clear that what these numbers measure, things like GDP, unemployment, inflation, and the world that most of us daily inhabit are not the same world. And I wanted to look into why is there such a disconnect between most of our experience of the world, sometimes for the better, often for the worse, and what these numbers tell us the world we're living in is. How'd that happen? And you know, one thing I kind of learned as an historian was that everything has a story. Everything has a history. Our numbers, just like our people, just like our ourselves and our families, and these numbers are not pre-existing laws of nature. You know, they're not natural phenomena. There was no GDP in Pleistocene times, and in fact, there was no GDP or unemployment or inflation or trade or housing in the 19th century or even in the early 20th century. And just to kind of look at the degree to which we invented these numbers very recently, and then even more recently than that, they became seemingly just part of the warp and woof of our daily lives. You don't have to care about the economy at all, but you've got some awareness of what these numbers are telling you. And, you know, again, to just kind of demystify that, look at what they actually do tell us versus what they don't, and then offer some thoughts about what we do about it.
I found the book fascinating, especially in your role as an historian, of talking about these numbers and how ultimately they became so powerful.
Yeah, and I think most of us, for good reason, don't really think about that. And look, most of us don't really think about these numbers. We just are forced to pay attention to them because they come at us via all these different media outlets on regular basis. So again, you could have no interest or understanding of this thing called the economy, but you're probably aware of what GDP is, or you're probably aware of what the employment rate is. You're probably aware of mortgages and housing because, you know, this comes at us. And, you know, I was surprised even to learn just how recently these numbers were invented. And they are invented. Even this notion of the economy, nobody talked about the economy before the 1930s, because before then, there were no numbers to describe it, right? The economy is a pretty abstract thing. It's really just a bunch of numbers to describe a system. And most of these were made up during the Great Depression, when people were aware of the fact that things were really bad, but we didn't have any really good way of figuring out just how bad things were. So things like the unemployment rate and GDP and national accounts were all created during the 1930s to help initially just policymakers in Great Britain and the United States figure out what was going on and figure out whether anything they were doing to help what was going on was working. And the other impetus was World War II, where, you know, the United States in particular needed to know just how much domestic factory production you could turn toward war manufacturing. You know, how many car plants you could make into tanks and guns without imperiling the domestic economy. And that was why these numbers got invented. And then, you know, by virtue of the 24/7 media cycle in the 1990s in particular, we suddenly started paying a lot of attention to them. But until then, you know, our grandparents and our great-grandparents didn't pay attention to GDP because there was no GDP figure to pay attention to, or unemployment, or consumer price index, or housing, or retail sales. That just none of it existed.
Why do you feel that they can be misleading?
Well, I think partly because of when they were invented. They're very good at measuring the 1950s. You know, they're very good at measuring an economy that is grounded in industrial national production of stuff. And GDP is primarily a measure of how much stuff we're making and how much stuff we're consuming. Robert Kennedy, right before he was assassinated in 1968, gave a very famous speech about the limitations of GDP, which was then becoming much more part of our political and economic discussion. And he was extremely critical and basically said, you know, GDP measures everything except that which is worth measuring, because it doesn't measure a pleasant afternoon spent with a friend. It doesn't measure the strength of our family relationships or our bonds or the health of our communities. And that's certainly true. But, you know, more to the point, it can only measure what it measures, right? It only measures how much stuff we make. And it's not very good at measuring the ideas that we invent, intellectual property. It's not very good at measuring Google. I mean, it can measure the ad money that's spent on Google. But the amount of time you and I save, or the amount of the worlds that open up because of all these free internet goods, GDP can't grapple with. Services, advice, you know, the stuff that we pay for globally but isn't a physical product, not very good at measuring. And all these numbers tend to act as if we're still largely in the 1950s, where domestic companies hire domestic workers to produce domestic goods and consume domestic stuff. And that's just not the world that we live in.
And it seems, in the way you just framed it, would indicate that then the real picture is somewhat better than it is advertised in these numbers.
I think the real picture is somewhat better than it is advertised for a portion of the population that can easily access and profit from those trends. And I think it's actually significantly worse for those portions that cannot. So for many people who were trained to do a job, particularly a job that required a certain basic amount of physical skills, the picture is actually a lot worse, because a lot of those jobs, you know, just are not going to be recreated. So one of the fallacies of our unemployment numbers and then our government policy is the belief that if government spends X, or if the economy grows by Y, then it will lead to X number of jobs being created, because that connection existed for a period of time in the 20th century. But today, you know, companies can make a lot of money, but unlike 50 years ago, where the assumption was, well, if a company made a lot of money, it would hire more people to make more stuff to make more money. Today, a company can make a lot of money because it's using robotics or information technology and have absolutely no need to hire more people to make more stuff. The same thing, you know, the government can spend a lot of money thinking that this will lead to employment, right? Because you will create more money and that will have firms and more easy loans. But as we know, you can spend a lot of money and banks will still not loan and companies will still not hire. Because in a global supply chain, right, goods and services are not procured the way they were when these assumptions were made. And I think, you know, in that sense, life is definitely better for those of us who are internet savvy, who are connected to services, who are generating ideas. And life is, I think, much worse than the numbers would say if you're in the camp of, you know, needing a job to do basic things.
One of the things that I found fascinating in the book is that these numbers came out primarily after the war, World War II, to the Great Depression, but a great turbulent time. And we've had great turbulent times since then, economically and culturally and socially. So why do those indicators then not change? Why do those formulas not change? Why do they not reflect all aspects and all facets of our society? Why can't that be done?
Right. So that is a great question. And it is certainly true if you talk to the people, for instance, in the government who compile numbers like GDP and numbers like inflation and numbers like, you know, national retail sales. And even if you talk to private groups, because a lot of these numbers are now created by private groups. And to be fair, they are created by private groups because then they get sold to companies and media organizations. So there's kind of there's a business of leading indicators as well, right? And that's part of the reason why they proliferated, because people will pay for information.
Right.
All these people are trying to tweak the formulas and adjust the way things are done, because it's not as if, you know, what I just said about services and information technology being an ever more important part of our economic lives, it's not as if the people who create these statistics don't know that. But there's a bit of a round peg square hole issue in that, you know, if you set up a building, right, that was designed in the 1950s, to handle the kind of electricity and wiring that was true in the 1950s, and you try to shoehorn in a modern technology into that structure, you know, you can try and you can adjust and you can tweak, but at some point, you know, it just, you can't easily force an old structure to adapt to completely new realities. And I don't think that's really the fault of anyone, but it's just that we're very dependent on these old frameworks, and we're not that good at inventing new ones. And part of what I argue in the book, in the leading indicators, is that the belief that you can create a couple of really easy, simple numbers to describe really complicated, multifaceted realities is part of the problem. We're not just going to invent a new number.
Right.
Because the idea that a 320 million person U.S. economy or 7 billion people strong global system is going to be adequately captured by one number like GDP or gross national happiness or any other number, that I think that's part of the problem.
And you put a lot of this on us in the sense of we have this data, we have this data revolution, all of these numbers, all of this stuff is out there and is available. And kind of, you point to us to say, okay, if you're going to buy a house, if you're going to move to a region, if you're going to do something that impacts your life, it's up to you to figure out where you are and what the situation is.
Exactly. And then part of the call in the book is, rather than hoping for better simple numbers, create your own simple numbers, because most of the questions you and I or a small business or even a large business have are answered by knowing what the question is and then finding the information that answers it, and not by GDP or by unemployment. Or, you know, we're talking a lot these days about income inequality and the problem of it. And I guess, you know, it is a systemic problem, but it's also true that, you know, if you're going to buy a home in your local area, the national mortgage rates released by the National Housing Association or inflation rates or employment rates or GDP really don't matter that much unless they're so bad or so good. And that's rarely the case. What matters is what's true in your local area if you're going to start a business. You know, it doesn't matter whether retail sales were up or down. It doesn't matter what per capita income is. And per capita income, by the way, is one of the worst measures of anybody's individual life, because there's that old line, and I've used this a lot. Bill Gates walks into a bar, and per capita, everyone's a millionaire. So it's statistically true, but it's not exactly helpful.
Right.
You know, what matters is what's going on in your local area. What are the trends of the business you're focused on? Not these large systemic numbers.
Okay, so with that said, where does your optimism lie?
My optimism lies in the fact that we have these powerful tools and that we are more able than ever to find the information that we need to answer the questions we have. I mean, if you wanted to know the dynamics of the local housing market 20 years ago, you would have had to, I don't know, go to the registry at City Hall and pore over documents. And I suppose if they would even have kept those or if they would have provided them for you. Now all you have to do is go onto one of the many databases that you can find via Google or any search engine. And in an hour, you can have a pretty good sense of the properties that have sold. You know, something like Zillow, I haven't used this, but, you know, that tells you every single property that's sold in a 10-block radius of where you're going to go. These tools are very powerful, and they allow you to answer a lot of questions as a business owner, as an individual, even as a government. You know, we should be targeting our policies much more, and we could. You know, there's no national unemployment rate that makes sense. There's a sub 4% unemployment rate if you're in Nebraska, because of the shale gas and grain prices. Texas hasn't had an unemployment problem. There's still terrible unemployment in Detroit and parts of Central California. We could adjust our policies to meet these very specific realities that we can now gauge. So I do think we have the tools to make much better decisions than using these very crude indicators. Whether or not we have the will to do so is, I think, a different question, but we clearly have the means to do so.
The name of the book is The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Zachary Carabel, I thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us this morning. Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is The Leading Indicators, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.